This is the IBJ podcast for the week of March 15th, 2021. I'm Mason King.
Here's Thomas, 1 second. Got it at the buzzer!
Oh, my. Farouk Benesh, a three.
Good!
Draymond Green finds Lucius for the win.
He got it!
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As I said, the date of this podcast is Monday, March 15th. By the time you hear this, some teams already will have started arriving in Indianapolis for March Madness. We're hosting 68 teams in all. The play-in games are on Thursday in Bloomington and Lafayette. The first round starts on Friday with most of the games in Indianapolis for the following 18 days. And away we go. It's going to be something. I want to remind you that IBJ will be on the ground covering all of the action off the court and some of it on the court as the world watches Indianapolis do what it does best. And you can follow our coverage at IBJ.com. I was thinking the other day, what is the real genius of March Madness, which I have always thought of as the greatest sporting event in America? How is it that the whole country seems to turn into a tight-knit village for 3 weekends? We hang on the outcome of each game, we fall in love with schools we've never heard of. And the answer, of course, is television. Television is the main medium for the madness. And it puts the ads in the madness, nearly $1 billion worth of TV ads every year. And the media rights deal to broadcast these games is the lifeblood of the NCAA. The Indianapolis-based governing body of college sports. The money that CBS and Turner pay the NCAA to broadcast these games makes up the vast majority of revenue for the NCAA. And a good deal of that money goes back to the conferences and the athletic departments of the schools and the student athletes. So, this 3-week tournament Indianapolis is about to host is a powerful economic engine for college sports, as well as a cultural institution, as well as a platform for advertisers seeking a national audience captivated in real time by a live event. And this year is particularly important because the tournament, of course, was canceled last year due to the coronavirus crisis, and the disbursements to colleges in the end were paltry compared to what they had expected before the pandemic. IBJ columnist and investigative reporter Greg Andrews examined the NCAA's media rights deal for March Madness in a front page story in the latest issue of IBJ. He's our guest on the podcast this week, so we can discuss the significance of broadcasting March Madness. Here's our conversation. I'd like to welcome back to the podcast Greg Andrews, IBJ columnist and investigative reporter. Greg, thanks for making time.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, let's just dive into it. I want to make sure I have a basic understanding of how the media rights deal works. Is it as simple as CBS Sports and Turner saying, okay, we'll give you X amount of money, $850 million, and we get to broadcast all the tournament and collect whatever advertising fees we can get? Is that too simple?
That's accurate, but advertising is only part of what they're getting. National TV advertising is the biggest chunk of their revenue. But Turner as a cable station is, or TNT as a network, is mostly reliant on the fees that it receives from satellite and cable TV networks. So it does receive advertising, and that's important, but the vast majority of its revenue is a $2.20 fee that every cable and satellite customer pays to have TNT on their station lineup. TNT is able to charge that $2.20 because it has very attractive programming that people want to see. That's the second highest fee of any network, except for ESPN.
So how much is the NCAA getting this year from CBS and Turner for the media rights deal?
$850 million.
And that has been going up steadily, right, for at least 30 years. I know, for example, that back in 1994, the NCAA agreed to a 7-year media rights deal worth $1.7 billion, and the average there would have been like $250 million a year.
That's right. It has marched higher and higher, with one exception that I'm certainly sure we'll talk about here today. But just as a basis of comparison, in 2007, the fee was $490 million, and the fee will continue going up in future years under the contract that continues until 2032. At 2025, it's $990 million. So it's just short of $1 billion in 2025.
So if the NCAA receives $850 million this year from the media rights deal, how big a percentage of NCAA's total annual revenue is that?
It's more than 70%.
So this is like the cash cow and the goose that laid the golden egg and the bread and butter all in one.
Yes, that's for sure.
I mean, what does the NCAA do with that money? How much of that revenue goes back to the conferences and schools?
The NCAA obviously receives this money, but it gets distributed across the country to colleges and universities, Division I, Division II, and Division III conferences and colleges. But the vast majority goes to Division I members. There's a formula that distributes it. One of the criteria is past success in March Madness. The more success, the larger the distribution under part of the formula. There's also an equal distribution to conferences, Division I conferences. There are distribution to pay for grants and aid and sponsorships. There's a student athlete academic need portion as well. The amount that went to Division I colleges and conferences in 2019 was $611 million. So when the trouble hit in 2020, the pain was felt across the country when Division I athletic budget saw a huge plunge in that distribution. It was just $246 million in 2020 because of the cancellation of March Madness that year and the financial implications of that.
Yeah, and we'll dive into that here in a second. I did want to ask kind of an existential question, which is, I mean, what would the NCAA be without March Madness and this incredible amount of money?
It certainly would be a much smaller organization with fewer employees. In the old days, I think people thought of the NCAA as largely an enforcement entity, catching cheating in sports and holding schools accountable, that sort of thing. That's still an important function, but the TV contract allows it to be a very powerful funding mechanism for big-time athletics.
This may be just me trying to burnish Indianapolis's image even more than the city already has done, but are we safe in assuming that one of the reasons that the NCAA wanted the tournament to take place in a single location this year is that it would give them the best shot at ensuring the games take place and the broadcasts happen on schedule?
I think it really comes down to the longstanding relationship between the NCAA and the Indiana Sports Corporation and other community leaders here. I think they feel comfortable that Indianapolis can do something like this and deliver. So I'm sure it's convenient to be in its hometown to have the championship games played here, but not every city could pull this off. And I think Indianapolis's record of past success hosting major events and fulfilling its word, living up to its word on all various commitments over the years, made the NCAA comfortable about this decision.
So in 2019, the NCAA made more than $1 billion in revenue, almost $867 million of that from March Madness, and most of that, $804 million from the media rights deal. How much did CBS and Turner get in national advertising? Let's just say just that.
Sports marketing experts I talked to for the story said the deal worked out very well for CBS and Turner in terms of there are a lot of revenue streams that are generated far beyond just national TV advertising. But just from national TV advertising, they received $910 million. So just that exceeded the fee. There was also, of course, streaming, digital ads. There's NCAA.com, NCAA March Madness Live website and app. So there are other paths to bringing in additional revenue beyond that national TV spend.
So we've been leading up to this. What happened last year when the tournament was canceled? How much money did that cost the NCAA in terms of the media rights contract?
Well, it was a pretty devastating blow. The NCAA only received $113 million under the contract last year. It had been expecting to receive more than $800 million. As a result of that, as I mentioned earlier, slashed the distribution to Division I members, and it also launched all sorts of cost-cutting efforts to reduce expenses wherever it could. One thing that helped it is that this incredibly, seemingly highly unlikely event, fortunately, the NCAA had purchased insurance that covered the cancellation of the tournament. And it certainly doesn't cover all of the losses, but it the payment from insurance was $270 million. So that offset some of what was lost on the media rights deal.
And then how did that affect the distributions to the schools?
Basically, it chopped them by more than half. So the Division I distribution in 2019 was $611 million. The Division I distribution last year was $246 million.
Wow.
So a lot of colleges around the country are really hurting with their athletic budgets.
Yeah, and I can see where they would be really interested in making sure this comes off again this year.
Definitely.
So why do advertisers want to be a part of this event so much? I mean, we talk a lot about how broadcast TV or cable TV is dying. What is so attractive about March Madness to advertisers?
There are several things, but one of the biggest is it's a massive live audience. Earlier generations of TV viewers, many of us would watch pretty much the same shows all the time. There were a lot of programs that had large mass audiences, but the audience has become very fragmented these days. And so you have your streaming services, you have lots of niche programming, but if you want a large mass audience, there are fewer places for advertisers to get that than there used to be. You mentioned the word live, I believe, and the word live is crucial because so much viewing is done on demand these days. And if an advertiser, say, is rolling out a new product or launching a big sale, that kind of programming is harder to sort of time with a big splash. Live TV gives the fact that everyone's watching, almost everyone is watching live, not on any sort of delay, is very valuable to the advertisers.
What is the average audience typically for the games?
Well, if you just look at CBS in 2019, the average audience for the games on that network was 7.6 million. And that happened to be a 14.8% increase from the prior year. It shows the continued strength as a draw. You know, there are other more nuanced benefits. March Madness is very much a feel-good event. In a way, some of the games, of course, draw mass audience, and some of them earlier in the tournament might get smaller audiences, but that also gives them more of an intimacy. It's just a really positive feeling that the tournament has that sort of brushes off on the advertisers.
One of the things that I've always loved the most about it is that for about 3 weeks out of the year, and especially that first weekend, it kind of feels like everybody in the world is looking at the same thing, or at least everybody you know is looking at the same thing. And there, it feels like the country becomes kind of a small town just for a little bit. So how long does this current media rights deal go?
It is scheduled to expire in 2032.
Oh, is that a long time? I mean, that's 11 years. Is that a long time to have a media rights deal?
That is a long time. Some NFL deals that are currently being finalized are shorter term. There is a benefit for the NCAA to have a quite long-term financial arrangements, given that so much of its revenue is coming from that contract. It would not want to be living on the edge with, you know, three-year contracts, and then that would just create great uncertainty about its financial underpinnings. Yeah, this is a very long-term contract, and it's actually goes back to 2010. In 2010, there was a contract negotiated that was going to run through 2024, but in 2016, CBS, Turner, and the NCAA decided to negotiate earlier, so negotiate an extension. And the eight-year extension took it from 2024 to 2032. So when the deal was renegotiated, it was actually covering 16 years.
So the NCAA probably wouldn't be interested in renegotiating before 2032?
The people I talked to thought neither side would probably be tremendously interested in renegotiating at this moment. For the networks, that's partly because it's a favorable fee. They're making money. They wouldn't want to necessarily negotiate something that forces them to pay more. But for the NCAA, I mean, there's just sweeping changes across media that are not entirely clear how they're going to shake out. And do you want to do a deal that takes you to 2040 when you're not really sure what players are going to be the most effective means to broadcast or to distribute March Madness in the future? You know, it could be, who knows, maybe Netflix is a key player next time around, or maybe there's a network that we've never even heard of that swoops in, or we're also seeing more and more of the viewership move away from something that came through your cable system, you know, and you're watching it on your large television in your family room, to more people watching on their iPad or their phone or their laptop through streaming services. So the media industry is really at a crossroads, and sitting back and letting the various parties to this contract see how things unfold for a few years might position the NCAA to be in a position to to make a deal that is more beneficial to it than if it were trying to predict what's going on in the 2030s.
What do Turner and CBS Sports need to do to be able to hold on to this event?
That's a good question. I think they're also changing, so it isn't as though changes in the media world will necessarily negatively affect them. All of the traditional broadcast networks are starting to get more and more into subscription streaming services, and that includes CBS, for example, just rolled out, I believe, Paramount Plus. So I think what would be highly unlikely would be that CBS and Turner would, under a new contract, be the same as they are today. They would be changing, they would be evolving. There are a lot of new technologies that can tailor the game to the fans' preferences. For example, and you're just starting to see a little taste of this, network can create different feeds for different audience bases. The NFL made headlines in January when it showed a wild card playoff game on Nickelodeon with SpongeBob and other characters, and presented in an entirely different way than a game would be presented on CBS, for example. So technology companies are increasingly interested in being players in this area. For example, Amazon Prime is, according to reports, on the verge of getting exclusive rights to most of the Thursday NFL games. And the more technology companies get in the picture, the more likely it is that we're going to see a lot of new technologies, which the traditional networks have been around a long time or certainly wanted to keep up. So there's pressure to innovate and improve the fan experience. So whoever has those rights, they're going to be a lot more bells and whistles under future contracts than there are today.
Did you mention the app? Who was it that came up with an app for watching the tournament?
NCAA March Madness Live app is, I think, what you're referring to. And that allows you to watch any game and pulls together social media feeds from various sources. It's tied into your, right now, it's tied into your, if you have a cable subscription or satellite or something along those lines, that's how you access the games. Turner, which handles that aspect of the contract, they handle social media, they handle various websites for the NCAA, and the app just came up with a revised version for this year's tournament that has a lot of bells and whistles that I suspect fans will like.
Well, thanks so much for taking time, Greg. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
My thanks again to Greg Andrews. You can read more about the tournament media rights deal in IBJ's latest print issue, which is filled with stories about Indianapolis's historic stint hosting March Madness. Susan Orr explains how local restaurants hope to capitalize on an opportunity to provide meals for the players in the tournament. Anthony Shutley reveals how audacious decisions made over the last 5 decades by local political and civic leaders paved the way for this opportunity. And you'll find a lot more in a special pullout section devoted to the ins and outs of this undertaking, the key leaders behind the effort, and what could happen next for the city. Again, it's all in the latest issue of IBJ, which you also can find online at ibj.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.